Good morning. I hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving and has well passed the tryptophan reaction to turkey and back to being alert again. I had a wonderful time last weekend when I wasn't here. I was up in Mendocino County sitting in a retreat where I had no teaching responsibilities. The last time I did that was in Japan. I figured it out. It was 8 to 9 years ago. My friend Yvonne Rand had a small retreat, and she'd invited as a guest teacher Tenzin Palmo. Now, some of you may have read the book about her called Cave in the Snows. Mm-hmm. She's an English woman who went to India when she was 19 or 20, because it was already clear that her path was to be a Buddhist, and was ordained as a novice early on and then practiced for 12 years with her teachers, and then for 12 years in a cave in the snows, and only left when she had visa problems. She would have happily stayed. And so after that, she started a training center for Tibetan nuns and schools, and she's built a really nice, a largish Tibetan nuns training center. Because the Tibetan nuns, Buddhist nuns, had no training in the past. They were just sort of supposed to, oh yes, we'll give you nonless ordination, I'll go wash the dishes. But it wasn't like then wash the dishes, now you do various kinds of practice, that was sort of what you did. So only now are they beginning to have the real training programs and learn studying and learn to debate. Some of them are now, they study English and Tibetan, some of them don't know Tibetan, they grew up in India, some are from Tibet, or some of them are just coming in still, not from Tibet right now, but from Bhutan and areas around there. She has 50, I think, training at any one time there. And so her travel tours, this was, I think, her last one, is primarily fundraising. And we had a lovely time. She taught every day. I could just sit there and listen and have chat a little. It was so refreshing. Anyway, also, since she is fundraising, she had a wish list of all the different kinds of things they need. So I'm putting out a little begging bowl with information. If we together put in $50, it will provide a winter cloak for one of these training nuns. The Tibetans, how traditions can't be changed. We have a tradition of keeping the right shoulder sort of bared to say always ready to serve. But we wear clothes, and then we have the okesa not on the right shoulder. The Tibetan tradition, unfortunately, is a bare right shoulder. And it's not in, Dalai Lama would love to change it. He scoured the text, she said, and it's not in the Vinaya, it's not in the original rules, but there's the tradition, and so even in a cold climate, they're supposed to have a bare right shoulder, but they can wear a cloak. The nice, fuzzy, warm cloaks they have. Of course, these women come with nothing. So I'll put out this begging bowl, and if anyone wants to contribute to a warm cloak for a young woman training in Tibetan Buddhism, that would be nice. It was very refreshing. And we'll have a session in January. I have the dates. I'll send an email out tomorrow. 3 days of refreshing sitting. And I'm simplifying it. Those of you who feel like you should have a badge, there's a badge that says I voted. There's the badge that says I survived session. I want to ease the schedule some, because Yvonne runs an eased, somewhat relaxed schedule. To say there should be lots of rest. And good longish break periods so that your body can recover, and so you can integrate that way. And what she does to hold it together through that is a very strong practice of silence and no reading or writing. So that we might shift a little bit that way and see whether we can not need to hand out I survived session buttons, instead have it be a way that integrates with your body as it is. I found that I had a lot of deep samadhi up there. That may be partly because I was away from home and not having any responsibilities. But it's not a session light. It's just a slightly different proportion and balance. So we'll have a 3-day session, and you can come for any 1, 2, or 3 days. You can stay over, not stay over. I'll send out the details. It's in the middle of the month. One of the things we talked about was samsara and nirvana, and that's what I want to talk about today. The story that always comes to mind for me is one that most of you, but maybe not all of you know, but I'll give it another twist, is the famous story of the difference between heaven and hell. In hell, there is a huge table laden with foods, and all the beings in hell gather around, but everyone is given a 3-foot-long fork. And it's just a little too long to get food into your mouth. So there you are, there's all this food, you're starving, this fork, and you can't feed yourself. You can't eat it. That's hell. It's right there, all of it, and you can't have it. And then heaven, turns out, has the same table, laden with the same foods, and the same 3-foot forks. But in heaven, everyone feeds the person on the other side of the table. Very simple, very sweet story. So in our tradition, if you substitute samsara and nirvana for heaven and hell, it's even more apt. Because it's not, it isn't that here's hell and there's heaven with the same setup, it's the same table. Then it's very full of a tremendous array of foods, nourishing foods, and also devil dogs, you know, unnourishing foods. I loved devil dogs when I was a kid, but they're not really nourishing. Junk food, there's everything from real food to junk food, right? The whole noisy, buzzing variety of life is laid out in front of us and visiting and stimulating our senses all the time. And samsara is the realm of unending unsatisfaction in the face of this. It's the unskillful response to the buzzing, noisy world of variety. It's, if you're hungry, it's worse if there's all that food out there and you can't have any than if there isn't any there. It's an extra irritating because your senses are taking in one message and yet you can't satisfy. That's samsara. And in the Mahayana, nirvana, the peace, the slaking of quenching of desire does involve all the other beings. You can't do it alone. It's not your private province, the practice or the seeking nirvana or your own private peace. There is no such thing really as your own private peace in the Mahayana Buddhism, because it's the very awareness that you're not alone. You're not just an isolated being. And if you're not just an isolated being, then this other being's welfare is your welfare, is linked to your welfare. Not that you lose your boundaries, but your boundaries expand. There's your needs and this other being's needs, and they are satisfied in an interconnected and interpenetrated way. We feed each other. And so it really is a very apt image for samsara and nirvana. Now, but in early Buddhism, samsara meant something else a little bit. I mean, they say the Buddhism is one of those traditions that evolves on purpose. So what something, if you read a book on early Buddhism or traditional Buddhism or Buddhism of the Elders, it's called, or Theravadan Buddhism as it's practiced now, it's going to have different meaning. You'll read that this existence is inherently suffering. That's the meaning of suffering, that's samsara, the world of suffering. And it's the world of cyclic existence, and everything you do ties you to this wheel of existence, and there's the only way out of this awful cycle of being tied to existence by everything that you want ties you down, and every time you satisfy your want, you still want more, and it still ties you down to the cycle. The only way out is out altogether, is to eject yourself, and that nirvana is somewhere else. That's not the way of Mahayana. But we have the same words and overlapping meanings, of course. Mahayana says, okay, you see, but for the mind, it's, I know I'm suffering here, and this is not the world of peace, so it must be somewhere else. This is how the mind works. And so the mind says, okay, this is samsara, and nirvana is somewhere else. And then we say, oh, well, really, it's almost none of my business, because here I am in samsara. I need to deal with suffering and problems and confusion. I want a little peace and quiet. I don't want to even hear about enlightenment or nirvana. It's too far out there somewhere. It makes me feel worse. It's like being in hell at the groaning board where you can't feed yourself. Right? So you feel tantalized and unable to satisfy yourself. But so the Mahayana says, okay, it may be a simpler concept that here's samsara and there's nirvana, but it doesn't really make sense because this is one world. This is one universe. There isn't a separate place called nirvana to go to. That's the way our mind makes all concrete images, the heaven and hell images. But that isn't really how it is. That's just how it looks to us. So Mahayana said samsara and nirvana are in the same place. It really is the same table. That they are two deeply seated attitudes or views to one reality. And of course, most of it, we live as humans in this deeply imbued with this view of samsara. And it's not as simple as to say, well, I'll put it down, you know, when we say, oh, I would like to do loving kindness meditation, we do that. We do that forgetting that we're doing that from within the province of samsara. If you can't just put it down and pick up something else, it doesn't work that way. It's too deeply seated in us. But it isn't our true and original nature. It isn't the actual nature of the world around us. It looks like that sometimes. Samsara is our ignorance about how things really are and the way we act on our ignorance. So, why consider them? Isn't nirvana something that's just really out of the realm of our world? And when we do think about it, we tend to make fantasies about it. Either it's too big and too far away, I don't want to think about it, or it becomes a great fantasy of like enlightenment, that I want to be enlightened or have enlightenment or something like that. So we either want to draw it to us, that's samsara, the craving desire, or we want to push it away. So we relate to it in terms of our own, our limited way of seeing things. So we tend not to talk about it a whole lot. Besides, it might seem too abstract or theoretical. But it isn't. Because samsara and nirvana are the underpinnings of your life and my life. They are, samsara is a deep-seated view of life that drives our actions. And so samsara is a way of describing the world you already inhabit. You know, we can describe the world in terms of gravity, and it's very useful in terms of physics of things moving together and attraction, repulsion, and dropping cups on the floor and breaking them, and you know, interplanetary going to the moon is useful, and trees falling over in the woods. You know, we live in a world where gravity is a very useful way of describing reality, but it isn't the way. Isn't useful for everything. It isn't useful for figuring out what to do next today, except if you're looking at whether you're going up and down stairs, you don't want gravity to send you down the stairs. So it's relevant. But so samsara is, again, it's not a complete description of everything. It's a very useful way to look at your life in terms of your actions, what drives your actions, and the suffering you experience. Or actually, you know, we say suffering. Most of us, most of the time, are not in acute suffering. So we say, well, I'm not really suffering. I don't want to talk about that today. But the word that gets translated as suffering really means unease or unsatisfaction, dissatisfaction. And there is a thread of dissatisfaction that runs so consistently through our lives that when we have satisfaction, it immediately followed by dissatisfaction. It comes up again and again and again. It's there, and when it actually goes down, it comes popping right back up like a little rubber ducky. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a lot more painful than a rubber ducky, but it runs through our lives, this kind of unsatisfied quality. And the Dharma says it's useful. It's not just, okay, it's a useful way to look, because the Dharma says we can do something about it if we can see clearly why it is that we're full of unsatisfaction, craving, and fear and anger. If we can see why that's happening, maybe we can do something about it. Can you transform your world? The world you live in, the world that comes out of your eyes. your relationship, yourself, which is your world, yourself and your world. Not that I say your world because it's who you are. It doesn't end at your skin. So the Dharma says, yes, it's possible. And second, this is our practice, this the activity of seeing samsara and making change to how we live based on how seeing what's going on. This is our practice. So our practice here is nothing less than addressing the deep-seated, life-filling and world-filling states of being driven by greed, hatred, and ignorance, which is my description, classic description of the prime movers of samsara, of the attitude of samsara. And people often say, I'm not interested, I'm not after enlightenment, I just want a little tranquility when I'm practicing zazen. And I sympathize with that. I want everyone to have a little tranquility. On the other hand, I say don't aim too low. This practice is about doing a wholehearted practice about what it is to be you. And you will be doing the practice of tranquility when you do that. Because it's a practice of tranquility that's a practice of a rich peace, in not just of a little small corner. It's, the difference isn't just philosophical. A little tranquility, if that's set out sort of as the goal, you can do that. We have this practice and there's nothing wrong with that. We should all have a little tranquility. The practice of zazen and other practices, many practices, can give you a little tranquility. And it's a wonderful breathing space. It's a little bit like the heavenly realm in the six realms of existence. The heavenly realm is where the pressure is off. It's not a permanent resting place. It's just a short-term vacation, and where you regenerate your energy and you come back into the world again. It's just one of six realms circulating around. So you can have bits and pieces of time, you know, space where you can experience some tranquility and some ease. But if that's all you aim for, then you're going to have this, will only exist in this separate little pocket. And it will be easily swamped, easily overrun by large circumstances, because it's set apart. It's one piece. If you do, this practice is about a practice that is, relates to your whole life, and it includes that kind of tranquility. Of course. I'm absolutely in favor of some tranquility. But that is one aspect, one part of something that comes along with doing a practice that is about meeting the fact that you live in samsara and nirvana simultaneously. What is this about? What does it mean to be really here? Your precious human life really is precious. So we want to take care of the whole in as deep and complete a way as we can. That kind of practice can sustain more jiggling and wiggling and shocks and earthquakes than a practice that just aims to give you a little tranquility. You know, when a really big shock happens, you don't feel you have any tranquility because there's too big a shock, but you've been doing a practice that is about your life and your ground under you. Even though it doesn't feel tranquil, you have a kind of stability for going through it because there's a sense of being present in your life. You know what it is to be meeting the world of samsara and suffering as your life. And there's a kind of stability in that, which makes it then easier also to experience some sense of settledness or tranquility. Now, in Zen we don't talk so much about nirvana. We don't generally describe zazen as the practice of nirvana, right? You haven't heard that one before, and you won't hear me now quite saying that. Because it, One of the reasons that samsara is so enveloping and deep in us is that as soon as we say, I'm here, you're there, we go on to saying, focusing on the differences between us and what I like about me and I don't like about you, or what I like about you and I don't like about me, or who's better or who's worse, all of this stuff comes tumbling on top of that. And nirvana is the absence of all that. All of that dividing and conquering and being conquered is not happening there. So there's no place for shame there or guilt, because there's nothing for that to attach to. So we don't have words for it. So it's really not something in a sense to actually be talking about. But in Zen, and in much of the Mahayana, we talk instead about prajna, about wisdom. It's really more or less the same. But prajna is the wisdom that it would be the underpinnings of nirvana. So we talk about prajna, about wisdom. In fact, all of Buddhism does. From the Eightfold Path, the Six Perfections, all of the streams of Buddhism talk about prajna, about wisdom. The wisdom of your true nature, whatever that might be. So then we have to say, okay, we don't know what our true nature is. What if we assume we really don't know what our true nature is, and that's okay, but there's a way to inquire about who and what we are and what's at the root of our life. Not an objective search. We're not going to standing outside and looking and saying, well, who am I, what am I, and what is wisdom, is doomed, really. It's useful to study and look at, but it won't get you very far on its own, because you've already created the break between yourself and what you're looking at. It's already not you if you're outside it studying it. So we emphasize practice, we emphasize doing, just sitting, just doing, taking care of this. We're saying, study and practice your life and wisdom and prajna and peace and samsara from inside, from while you're living in it. And you can do this because you aren't just samsara, you are already Buddha nature. You're already of the nature of awakening, squished, piled up on by our samsaric delusions, our ideas of all the separation and differences and problems of our life. A monk once asked the great master Joshu, Joko's in my favorite Zen master, one of our favorites, old Chinese master, asked, what is nirvana? And Master Joshu answered with a verse. He said, she who skips and dances on the great way is face to face with the nirvana gate. Just sitting with a boundless mind, next year spring is still spring. So, the great way, the great Buddha way, is a very serious thing. It's so serious that you really should skip and dance. It's not serious we should be dour about it and grim. It's so, too serious to be grim about. It's your life, skipping and dancing, your vivid life of skipping and dancing on the great way, on the Buddha way. When you are vividly alive in the Buddha way, you're face to face with the Nirvana gate. And he explains that in our terms, just sitting. It's the earliest occasion I know of the phrase just sitting. Just sitting with boundless mind. That's our zazen. Just sitting with boundless mind. Now, my mind isn't boundless in zazen. All these thoughts are coming up. And then in between and underneath that is your boundless mind already present. And once in a while, you know it. And sometimes, even when you're caught after some time of practice, even when you're sort of caught up in thoughts and carrying on in your mind, still you know at the same time that your mind behind that is also boundless. It isn't that that isn't all that is you and your mind at that time. We kind of hope that if we know our boundless mind, our life will change completely. And films and stories kind of imply that. And then he had this great shock, enlightenment, and his life changed forever. Well, it's kind of a dramatic expression. Sorry. It does change your life forever if you take it seriously. You say, oh, I need to pay attention to this. I need to be informed by this. It does change your life, but not as though suddenly you never left samsara behind. You never leave samsara behind as long as you're living in a body and have a mind that's in the next minute going to create another idea. It's a great thing to have another idea. And then the next minute, second, nanosecond, is going to believe that idea to be a solid existing reality. Back to samsara. In fact, just sitting with a boundless mind is absolutely wonderful. And spring will still be spring next year. That's a good thing. Actually, winter will still be winter. It'll still be damp and chilly. And we need it. If we don't have winter and rain, we're going to be far worse off. Even though we may like it one day and not like it another day. I still love these winters. I spent too many winters in Minnesota and New England to feel anything but grateful for this kind of winter and the rain and the gray and the fog. And then partly because I know it'll go away again, too. This is not Seattle, right? So one of the reasons I can enjoy the winter is because I know that it's part of a cycle, that it won't always be winter. The sun will come out. The rain will stop. Not on my schedule. I have to hope the rain starts. But it isn't supposed to. There's no rain in the 10-day forecast for Zen Fest. That's, you know, but we take what we get. Last year it poured on Zen Fest. The last 2 years, I think, it poured. And we did fine. But it's nice to have nice weather. So we have all this coming going. I want it to be this way. I don't want it to be that way. Spring is still spring. Winter is still winter. But how much better for us to be just sitting with a boundless mind. And then we can really say, oh, this is winter, and this is spring, and here am I wanting it to be otherwise, here am I letting go of seeing myself wanting it to be otherwise, letting go of wanting it to be otherwise, sitting here, and then it'll start all over again. And here is me learning not to mind that this will keep happening. That's a hard one, to get past the compulsion of criticizing yourself or dejection when, once again, you have another deluded cycle going. Get caught up in it. So, in Zen we have a two-sided approach. You live in samsara. We don't try to put you in someplace else or claim you're someplace else. You're living in samsara. But that's not the nature of the world. That's the nature of our understanding of the world. The many phenomena are not themselves somehow wrong. They just are. They are what is. Samsara is our misunderstanding it and clinging and not being feeling unsatisfied because we are driven by our mind's ideas of how it ought to be and how it isn't and our greed and our anger and our ignorance. Living in samsara as part of your Zen life isn't just to say, oh well, I've been working on oh well since I got to Sonoma County. It doesn't come easily. It'll take a while from the East Coast. Decades, maybe, right? New Yorkers never really get it. They never really get it. Oh, well. Nice. We live in samsara. We live as if this world were really samsara. And we learn from it. And we dig into it. And we examine it. There's a great richness of to study and to learn from about samsara. We don't just pop out of it. It doesn't work that way. And we live in the Buddha world at the same time. We already live this world is all here. We bring the deep-seated view of samsara to a world that is already many different things and one world, so-called world of Buddha. The world as it is the world, is the underpinning, the world just as it is, where nothing hinders anything else. From our point of view, everything hinders everything else. From the point of view of the fact of life coming up and coming going down again, that is the Buddha world of emptiness and fullness at the same time. The world of prajna, the world of nirvana, is already here. As Hakuin says, this very land is the lotus land of liberty. So we do our zazen as Buddha practice, as the practice of sitting, not as if we were Buddhas, but sitting with our own Buddha-ness, our own Buddha mind, our own Buddha nature. It's there, and sometimes it comes up. You can't just sort of say, well, here it is, and pull it up a little. Letting go of our deep-seated samsaric view for a moment, that's what's already there. And the experience of it is peace and tranquility. The subjective experience of it. So when we do zazen, we are living in samsara and living in nirvana. When we do zazen, we are practicing with the worlds of samsara and nirvana in the same time and place, right here, right now. You know, when we talk about in zazen, dropping off body and mind, or letting go of your thoughts, or opening the hand of thinking, we're not just talking about a technique. When it's just a technique, it can give you a little corner of tranquility. And it's a good technique, but it's not just a technique. Because what you're doing is dropping off that deep-seated view of samsara that so fills our minds, all of those thoughts about clinging and grasping. And at that moment, when things drop away, that experience of peace, that's the experience of living in the emptiness of things, where things are not just as they seem, hard and cold and dangerous, and to be clung to and rejected. At the time when thoughts are just thoughts, that's the time when we can let go of them. When a thought is just a thought, you go, here's a thought, goodbye, here's a thought, goodbye, here's a thought, goodbye. That's when we're aware of the emptiness of thoughts. They also are full. They're full of a lot of, there's a whole neuron and a lot of neurotransmitters happening, and there's also the content of that thought. I'm happy, I'm sad, he likes me, doesn't like me, I'm making sense today, I'm not making sense today. Right? All of those thoughts are the aspect of the thought that we then cling to and reject and have all these responses to and get all caught up with. Now, there's nothing wrong with thoughts having content. They do. And we can't talk to each other or write a poem or interpret our experience without thoughts having content, feelings, and ideas. But that's not all they are. They're not solidly that. They are at the same time empty of being the thing we're thinking about. A thought is not what it is, what you're thinking about. The thought about whether I'm making sense or not is not the same as whether I'm making sense or not. So I need to know that aspect of thoughts. That's the emptiness of thoughts. It doesn't negate them. It's not an erasure that, you know, erases anything. It says, oh, thought is not the thing I'm thinking about, the same as the thing I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about a blue sky coming through. Will the fog break? Will it be sunny this afternoon? That's a thought, but the thought is not the same as the sun in the blue sky. And most of the time, we relate to our thoughts in terms of just the correspondence. I'm thinking about sun. It's all about sun and blue sky. we need to also, without negating that, also know that this is a thought. So I can have a thought that is intensely pleasurable or intensely unpleasurable, as well as one about whether the fog will lift, knowing that it is a thought, not being so captivated by it. Then I can be more skillful in my own life of my own thinking. That's living with the emptiness of thought. And the experience of that is peaceful. When I'm not caught up in and arguing with myself about my thoughts and how I shouldn't care about whether, or should I, or shouldn't I care about whether I'm making sense and if the sun's going to come out, right? It gets so complicated. When we drop that complication, for a moment, life is very peaceful. That's the experience of emptiness. Emptiness isn't something to be scared of. It's our own self and our own life when things open out. So we do Zazen as samsara and nirvana, or delusion and wisdom, in the same time, in the same place, right here, all the time. And sometimes we relate more in terms of the manyness and complications of things, still at samsara and nirvana at the same time. The more we know that we are simultaneously in samsara and nirvana, the more we know ourselves as capable of living in our lives, not just driven by our thoughts, but having them. Not always compelled by them, that we are here and we are together as not only as different, but as the same, as connected. The more we experience that, for instance, in Zazen, the more that becomes part of us in a way that then carries forth in other aspects of our life. So another monk asked Joshu, how is the mind put to use throughout the 24 hours of the day? That's basically this question. What do you do when you get off the cushion? And Joshu said, you are used by the 24 hours. I use the 24 hours. Very simple and sweet. Another really nice little pair. The experience of living in samsara is being used by the 24 hours, pushed around by them, shoved around by them, knocked over by them, dragged around and strangled by them, trapped by them, a slave to the clock, to our work, to our schedules, to our lists, to all the things there are to take care of, to the differences, to what we like and don't like about this time and that time. That's samsara. When Joshua says, I use the 24 hours, he's not saying that he manipulates them. He says, I work freely in them. I'm not hindered. I'm here employing the 24 hours as a way to clothe and express my life. The 24 hours take shape out of his activities, right? Rather than our activities being shaped and driven by the clock and the 24 hours. So that might be a way to see that coherence of our practice of samsara and nirvana, or delusion and wisdom, both experienced on the cushion and throughout the day. At any time we can stop, remember that we are not just creatures. We are not from end to end a slave to 24 hours. That's our samsaric view. And we stop, we drop it. And then we pick it up again. And sometimes we put ourselves, one of the things that is really good about Sesshin, for instance, or the retreat I was at, where I would like our Sesshin to be easier to enter that world, is that at that time there's only one thing to do at any one time. Time to sit, time to rest, time to eat, time to work, time to walk. I'm going to extend and play with walking meditations more as well. And that we're not being used by the 24 hours then. The Doan takes on that absorbs that poor karmic role of having to pay attention to the clock and keep track of things. It's a great bodhisattva gift that they offer to the rest of us. And they ring a bell and we sit down, they ring a bell and we stand up. First you check the schedule, can I do this? Right? So I want to make it something we can say, yes, I think I can do this. Then you just enter it. And you find, you know, it doesn't happen to me anymore, but it certainly did for the first 20 years or so of my practice, that as the time came closer to a practice day or a session, it would feel like there had been a broad river of my life, and there was a rapid, it was getting narrower, it was going faster and faster, and I'm not so sure I want to go into this. Maybe I don't have time for this. Maybe I really cannot go. If we start to feel that we're going to be trapped. And of course, it's actually the opposite. We're just becoming more aware of the way we live already trapped. We are going to change our way of relating to ourselves and time. But actually it is very freeing, not very entrapping. The mind gets confused by that. Goes, oh, change here, danger, danger. Actually, it's a very positive kind of a change. You know, we will always be in the world of where there are 24 hours and many things to do. Is the world of many phenomena. That's not in itself suffering or samsara. That's the world as it is. That's a world of 24 hours. The question is whether we are used by the 24 hours or whether we use them, whether we are trapped and jerked around by our ideas about what's going on, or whether we employ time and our hands and life to express something of life. Birds are calling. I think it's time to close. Why don't we do the verse, our closing verse first, and then we'll have some important things to talk about.